You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Thank you very much for being here with us today. It is a great pleasure here for us at Brookings to host this two very important flagship reports by the Corporación Andina de Fomento and the Banco Interamericano de Desarrollo on a topic that I think, in a sense, needs to be discussed in a very systematic and deep way, as these two reports do. I mean, how do you design the new generation, if there is something that we can call that way, of tax reform, in a way that we promote productivity, reduce income inequality, protect natural resources, while at the same time empowering citizens in order to give them the incentives to both control the efficiency of public spending and thus creating a virtuous circle between the willingness to pay taxes and the quality of public services. And to discuss those topics, I mean, we have an outstanding panel today. We have Pablo Sanguinetti, who is the Director of Socioeconomic Research at the CAF, the Development Bank of Latin America. Pablo is also a professor of economics at the Universidad Torquato di Tella in Buenos Aires, and he has a PhD from UCLA. We have Jose Juan Ruiz Gomez. He's the chief economist and manager of the research department at the Inter-American Development Bank. Jose Juan was 17 years at the Banco Santander as the chief economist of the Latin American divisions and held various positions at the Spanish government and is a graduate from the Universidad Autónoma de Madrid. Vicente Fretes is the division chief of fiscal and municipal management of the sector of institutions for development at the Inter-American Development Bank. And he has also taught at the Universidad Nacional del Nordeste and North Carolina State University and has an MBA from UPenn and a PhD from the North Carolina State University. Bueno, Augusto de la Torre, that you all know very, very well in the city, is the chief economist for Latin America and the Caribbean at the World Bank, former head of the Central Bank of Ecuador, and a PhD from the University of Notre Dame. And Michael Keane, the deputy director of Fiscal Affairs Department of the International Monetary Fund and professor, former professor of the at the University of Essex and Kyoto University. So we are going to proceed. Pablo will have 15 minutes to present the CAF report. Then Jose Juan and Vicente will have 15 minutes overall to present the IDB report. Then we'll probably sit down and Augusto and Michael will make to six to 8 minute initial comments and then we'll initiate a discussion among us and with you all. Okay? So welcome and thank you. Pablo.
Thank you very much, Ernesto. Thank you, Brookings, for organizing this. For me, it's a great opportunity to share this with our colleagues from IDB to present these two reports and have a discussion with you guys. So I hope you understand my Italian accent, okay? So I will speak a little bit slowly. So this is our report, Public Finance for Development, Strengthening the Connection Between Revenues and Expenditure. I hope at the end of the presentation you will be clear about why this connection is important and what are the keys, the key policies to promote that. So the books argues that there is a fiscal, of course, relationship between the state and the citizen that's going through taxes and expenditures. We know expenditures are very important to foster growth. You know, there are a lot of market failures there, so you need public goods, and this is important to like education, public health, etc. But also the state is important to not only to solve allocation problems, but also to do redistribution. So the state have implemented a lot of social programs, redistributed programs, to help, you know, improve income distribution and the poor. On the tax side, of course, there are very important decisions about the structure of taxes, how much direct taxes, how much indirect taxes, how this combination could also reduce efficiency cost and improve income inequality. And, of course, there's a big thing about how to collect these taxes, about administration to fight evasion. Now, the book has a first part that tries to offer a diagnosis of this expenditure and taxes decision of, in the last 20 years by Latin American governments, and whether this has improved or have helped to strengthen, again, growth and income distribution. But the book has a second part, which I think is the noble part of the book, in which we say that to improve the quality of public management and to improve both taxes and expenditure decision, maybe you have to look at two more, institutional, political economy factors that could connect tax decision and expenditure decisions in a way to give incentives to public administration to be efficient and to do well their jobs. These are these reciprocity and accountability channels. By reciprocity, we mean that if public expenditure are managed in a good manner with less corruption and is provide good, public goods that people care about, people may be more willing to pay taxes. And of course, this reciprocity do not replace enforcement policies. Okay? Now, if people pay taxes, especially taxes that are visible, that you know decline their private consumption, etc., so they are costly in terms of private consumption, taxes could also empower people, give people incentives to participate politically, so that to assure that the government is accountable about what to do with the resources. So this accountability channel would increase efficiency in the public administration and, of course, would improve the provision of public goods, which would improve, the willingness to pay taxes. And eventually, you can have a virtuous circle between taxes and expenditure through these two type of waves that are these policies are connected. So the second part of the book gives some evidence about whether we have these reciprocity and accountability channels connecting this type of fiscal policies. Let me go first very rapidly, because I don't have too much time, on the expenditure side. On that account, you will see, of course, in the last 20 years, that public expenditure in Latin America have increased from about 23% of GDP to almost 28% of GDP. And mostly, this is explained by the increase in social expenditures. Okay, first education that went to 3.2% of GDP to almost 5, and also social security and social assistance that went up from 5 to like 8.5%. Of course, this is nothing new. Developed countries in the last century increased the size of the state mainly because of the development of the welfare state. Okay, now, how much this public expenditure have helped to improve income inequality? We know that public expenditure improves income inequality through three channels. First, access to public goods. If the poor families could access to education and health, this will improve the chances to get more income, etc. Second, of course, income transfers, conditional cash transfers, that are very popular in Latin America in the last 10 years. This is direct help money to get to the families. And a third way is public expenditures allocated to subsidies in transportation, energy, gasoline, etc. We have, of course, taxes could also potentially help to improve income distribution, depending on how the structure of taxes is designed. Now, we have made an exercise, fiscal incidence, about how much this expenditure and tax decision have helped to reduce income inequality in five countries in Latin America, Peru, Bolivia, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina. I will present now the cumulative effect of different taxes and expenditure policy. If we start just talking about direct taxes and social security contributions, you see that the reduction in the Gini is very small. And this is because direct taxes are not an important source of revenue from many governments in Latin America. If you include direct transfers conditional cash transfers, you see an improvement in inequality. The Gini falls, for example, 8% in Argentina, 5% in Brazil. When we include the effect of indirect taxes and subsidies, gas, energy, etc., you see the accumulated effect is reduced compared to the... Why? For example, Argentina, because many of these subsidies are not very much focused on the poor, like gasoline, etc. So in Argentina, it goes down to 4%, the inequality indicator. The big thing comes when you add, of course, expenditures on public goods, health and education, which is much more important in budgetary terms, and also now in the recent years, the poor have access to these services. So, for example, in Argentina, the Gini went down by 23%. Now, this is good, but you have to take into account that in OECD countries, this account, the Gini goes down 40% because of the state. So we are in a, not just there. Now, so expenditure could help to reduce inequality, but also efficiency is important. How this money is spent, how we can avoid, wastes, etc. So let me go to, the problem is how we measure efficiency, okay? And in the book, I don't have time to go into the result, we say that we have to compare results, outputs, say the access to public education by secondary youth, for example, or reduction in mortality, infant mortality, etc. So results, outputs, but also we have to compare them to inputs and the environment. So the idea is, in the case of schooling, how much teacher per student we have. And also the environment. The children, from what type of families they come, families that are high level of socioeconomic level, so parents can help in the education of children. So that's the way we can get an efficiency index to measure the efficiency in the public sector. We did this for Chile and Peru, and we show, for example, for Chile, in depth, this graph, for example, the grades in the secondary schools is on the left hand side. You see that, of course, private and public schools, if you just look at grades, you will see that private schools are much more efficient compared to public, because on average they have much higher grades. But of course, if you consider inputs, okay, and the background of the families of the students, you see that the two curves get together. So public schools in Chile are not much inefficient compared to private schools. You do the same in Peru, you see that still there is room for improvement in the public management of public schools. Okay. Now, if you want to improve the quantity and quality of public goods, this will require, of course, strengthening the tax collection. So the question is Latin America making the necessary effort at tax collection? Here we have a graph on GDP per capita and tax collection as a percentage of GDP. And, of course, you see first that there is a positive relationship. You know, as countries develop, the state grows in terms of GDP, and the taxes grows in terms of GDP. But, of course, seems to be a limit, upper limit, about 40%, 38% of GDP. Now, the important thing here is that most of the Latin American countries are below the curve, so showing that for the level of income of these countries, they are not doing, compared to other countries, at least, with the same level of development, they are not doing the enough effort at that collection, you see? Just Brazil is above the line, and Argentina is just on the line. Now, why is that we have this lower tax collection effort in Latin America? Two reasons. First, tax structure, and second, tax administration. Regarding tax structure, you see that the problem is that income taxes, direct taxes, which is the second line, are not getting enough share within total taxes. This is the evolution of the tax structure during the last 20 years. We see an important increase in the indirect taxes, VAT, during the 90s. you have, at that time, there was the, all the reforms in the VATs. That's okay. They reach almost 38% of total taxes. Direct taxes, income taxes on firms and families, did not change a lot in the 90s. Only in the 2000s, they increased their share to 28%. But this was mainly due to the income taxes charged to firms. And within firms, those that are related with natural resources. Direct taxes on wealth and income on families are still very low in the region, just 1.3% of GDP. In OECD countries, the average is around 9%, almost 10%. Okay? Now, the low tax effort is also related with the weakness of tax control. Of course, there's a lot of evasion, 27% as an average on the VAT in Latin America, Chile 11%, but Nicaragua almost 40%. The evasion on income taxes even higher, on average 52%. Mexico 41% of evasion, Ecuador 64%. In US, sorry, I'm going too fast. I'm going to, okay. Ecuador, US is just 16%. So I give you so far a kind of diagnosis about expenditure and tax decision in the region. But maybe if you want to improve this policy, fiscal policy, we argue that there could be a complementary way to do that, which is fostering this, what we call reciprocity and accountability channels. So the idea is, again, reciprocity means better expenditures maybe could affect willingness to pay taxes by the people. Of course, again, this is complementary to enforcement policies. And the accountability channel, when you tax people, people have more incentive to, you know, control the government, and this will improve public management. So the idea is to evaluate now taxes and expenditure decisions in terms of if they foster this kind of institutional or political economy forces. Okay, that's the idea. So, but before doing that, how much evidence we have on these reciprocity and accountability channels? Let's start with the reciprocity. We have done a survey in 17 cities in Latin America, asking the people if they are more willing to pay taxes if the government improves performance. And we got some results, some positive results, in the sense that people are willing to pay more taxes if corruption is removed, if they improve health and education services, if the government gives more, improve citizen security, more protection for the poor. Of course, this is some evidence, qualitative evidence, but of the response to this to these questions could be opportunistic. So it's not totally very hard evidence about reciprocity. So what we do is we get some complementary evidence. We did an experiment, field experiment, in 17 cities of Latin America. We randomly assigned to each family some good and bad information about their local governments. Okay? They have to choose envelopes. So sometimes they got the good information about the improvement in traffic congestion, the improvement in social security services, or the other way around, whether homicides were increased in the city, etc. And so the idea was whether we can exogenously affect perception about the quality of local government, and then relate that to questions about if they are more willing to pay taxes. Okay, so this is a kind of a more credible evidence about the potential of this reciprocity channel. And we find that in Rio de Janeiro, positive information about the local government increased willingness to pay taxes on VAT and also on cars. There is also more evidence on that. This paper by Timmons we have commissioned. In Brazil, there were some audits made randomly to some local governments by the federal authorities. And then the federal authorities released information about that certain local governments, municipalities, have been, you know, not doing well with their finances, with some corruption, and others weren't doing well. Well, we find evidence that in those municipalities that the information from the audits was good, was bad in the sense that there was some corruption episode, afterwards people start paying less taxes. So again, this is sort of evidence about this, supports the idea of a reciprocity channel. But now, let's go now to the other, the accountability thing, which is, we believe is much more important. Of course, people doesn't like to pay taxes, but citizens, when citizens pay taxes, they feel they have more right to ask for a good public administration. We asked this in our survey, and 72% of the households in Latin America agree on this. But maybe the most important evidence about this accountability channel, the fact that people is empowered when they, you know, you tax them, so they will take, will look for, look after the government to, if they do wrong things, comes from independence episodes in Latin America and even here in North America. You know, when the colonial governments ask for taxes, but without giving them some political representations, people get mad because now they see they have to pay taxes, but they have no control what the money is doing with the taxes, so they ask for independence. Okay? So this historical evidence is consistent with this idea of accountability. Now, in the book, I don't have time to go, we have evidence about when governments get their money not from taxes, but from, let's say, royalties, from natural resources exploitation. In there, the necessity to finance expenditure from taxing the people is somehow broken. And this is the accountability channel works. This implies that this money, this expenditure that is financed by these royalties, maybe is not going to be spent in a good way. You may have more episodes of corruption, etc. We actually find evidence on that for Peru and for Brazil. So again, this is consistent with the idea of taxes as empowering people, and that this helps, you know, the people then will try to take care of the government and watch the government. Now, I try to convince you that there is evidence then of this accountability and reciprocity factors, and that this could create eventually a virtuous circle that would explain the growth of the state through the development path. How do you explain that at the beginning of the 20th century, Great Britain have a level of state level expenditure like 10% of GDP, and at the end of 2000 it was 40% of GDP. This should be more than just good design taxes and expenditures, you know, from a fiscal point of view. It must have a citizen legitimacy. It must have another reason, more political reasons. And this is what we are arguing here. Of course, between taxes and expenditure, there are some institutions, especially budget institutions, that intermediate and could also help to make that connection more clear. I mean, you know, the Congress, the Office of the Planning, offices of the Executive Power, the Audit Office, etc. Those institutions, if they allow for political participation, for, you know, transparency, for giving more information of the, to the people about what money is getting from where and where is spending, that also could help to foster or to, you know, this relationship, this accountability and reciprocity forces. So fiscal institutions are also important. Let me finish saying that direct taxes are important then, and especially direct taxes are important and potentially because they are a very good source of public revenues. For example, taxes on individuals may not have a strong efficiency cost, and also they help with the redistribution. But now we know that direct taxes could also imply, you know, this idea of empowering the people to control the government. So direct taxes are also important to, you know, to improve the quality of public management. Of course, many of the Latin American countries will have this natural income coming from natural resources. Okay, so what is important is to assure that these resources are first, there is a lot of information and transparency about the use of these resources. And of course, there are a lot of fiscal rules that are applied for that. And third, if we are going to tax people, which hurts, we better do it in the right way, with a professional independent tax administration. And this is very important. Even though taxes hurt, I may be willing to pay taxes if I know that everyone is treated in the same way. No, not because of political colors, whatever. So the tax administration is somehow independent of political pressures. Okay? So this is very important because this will help to also what we call more tax morale. Okay? Tax morale. I finished then saying that taxes are important not only because they give more revenue to the government, this could foster in a direct way growth because of public goods and could improve public income distribution. Taxes are very important to strengthen democracy because they empower people, they incentivize people to take care of the government, and so this also have indirect effects on development. Thank you very much.
Hello, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here again. I would like to thank Brookings, of course, and Ernesto for inviting us and to give us the opportunity to present our flagship. I will try to see in the fact that CAF and the EIDB has made a flagship on taxation something of a signal that something is going on in Latin America and something is changing in Latin America. These two institutions, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, would have not prepared a flagship on taxation, on public expenditure, as has made the CAF and things. I guess that this is a signal, a strong signal, that something is changing in our continent. Maybe for this reason you deserve some explanation of the process that took the IDB to invest money and resources to get the flagship that you can now have in your hands. In the year 2007, the IDB called for a process of consultation that we call the San Jose consultation process, and we asked for trying to identify the five top priorities to change the continent. And we were quite surprised because among these five priorities, what we identified was that the biggest challenge, but also the biggest opportunity to increase growth and to make a much more inclusive growth was the change in the tax structure and the institution that govern fiscal policy in Latin America. This was 2007, and we began to invest resources. And 5 years later, we produce this flagship, More Than Revenues. And it's not just a book. As I was telling you, something has changed in the continent. Something has changed in the continent because in these last 7-8 years, Latin America has been one of the regions of the world in which the tax revenues has been growing at a faster pace. In fact, is the region in which tax revenues has been growing the highest rate of growth, has got the highest rate of growth. And this means that politicians, policymakers, has also been taking care of all these issue of taxation. The question that we also identified was that although things are beginning to change, a long way it's in the region before we can be satisfied with the tax structure and the incentives that this tax structure introduces in our economic system. And this is for two reasons. On the one hand, because most countries in Latin America has not reached their potential revenue capacity, they are still raising much lower amount of taxes that they can get from their societies. And the second, and maybe even more important, that's the sufficient of revenues, is that we don't have a tax structure that is identified, has been designed to promote growth, to promote development. We have still a tax structure we introduced in the economy the worst and the bad incentives to allocate resources, and which are, for, in this sense, are responsible for not, for Latin America not having the rates of growth that they could possibly get. This is our flagship. Here you have our agenda, our outline of the book. The book. I just try to give you two quotations from two very important people, just trying to bring you to your attention and to your desire to read the book. On the one hand, Vito Tanzi, something that maybe is very well known for most of you, say, after reading the book, the book will become a monument to Latin American taxation. And in fact, this was my first idea when I go through the book, because really it's, you have there everything. You have from the tax forest to the tax trees, and each of the taxes has been analyzed, and you also have something that is my second quotation. The quotation comes from Fernando Enrique Cardoso, and Fernando Enrique Cardoso say, it's a very valuable source of practical knowledge for all the committed to promote economic efficiency and social justice in the region. This is, I think, is what we have tried to do, to balance a very deep and thorough analysis of what is the tax system in Latin America and each of the taxes that build this system. But also we have tried to give an orientation to make the reforms, to have practical value, to get some practical principles to know how to change and how to transform this tax structure in an instrument to growth. And I will, although Vicente is going to tell you much more about the details of these ideas of the tax system, I just would like to leave with you five principles that, in my opinion, are very important and that has to fit these proposed reforms in Latin America. I think that the first idea is very clear, and Pablo has been has given evidence of the need to do that. We need to have taxes that favors the poor. And I think this is important. Latin America needs to have a real and progressive income tax. We don't have. Or we don't have, in most of the countries, we don't have a real and progressive income tax. The second idea is very clear. We need, as you have seen in the forest of our tax system, we need to have a much simpler tax system, a much, much simpler with broader basis. Otherwise, I don't think this is going to be possible to change the nature of our tax system. The third idea also has been highlighted by Pablo. And for most of the people who approach to the analysis of the fiscal system in Latin America, we need much better tax administration because we need to reinforce compliance with the law. We were talking before coming here that just 3% of the total invoices which are made in Latin America receive an audit in Latin America, taking into account that we have an economy in which we have a 50% of informal economy. We are talking that the probability of being detected by an in-depth audit in Latin America is less than 0.2%. It's nothing. And maybe this explains the numbers of fiscal fraud that just has been in the presentation made by Pablo. We need, and I think it's also in very complementary to what has been expressed by the CAF, we need to be sure that local governments, which are near the citizens, have enough taxes to really play the role of agents of development. And finally, we need a tax system which it's beginning to think about future. We cannot have a continent which is always identified with natural resources, but in which natural resources and environmental taxes are playing a very, very minor role. I think these are the five principles that you can get from our book. And maybe now I am going to give the floor to Vicente to go to some of the myths that also are around the Latin America. I have more a lot of things in my presentation, but I think I prefer to hear from Vicente, which are the myths of Latin America, and after in the Q&A, go to some of the major distortions that are created and the cost that Latin America have to pay for using this, or for accepting this distortion in the tax system. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Thank you, Brookings, and particularly Ernesto, for organizing this event. As Juan Jose has mentioned, I would like to touch on three or four aspects of what we have found in our book. The first things that come out very strongly is that the structure of taxation in LAC is usually described as suffering from three major shortcomings. One, the tax burden is low. Second, taxes are regressive. And third, tax evasion is rampant. And some of these issues have already been discussed. This description is quite accurate, but however, things have changed, particularly in the recent developments in the region. So in these presentations, I would like to focus on some aspect of these three shortcomings and whether that is still reality and they reflect the reality of the region or they are becoming myth in this sense. So, and finally, I would like to conclude my presentation with some policy reform that emerged from the discussion. First, is the tax burden low in LAC? And this is the reality, yes, particularly in personal income tax. But this has to be quoted in a context where there was significant changes and improvement in tax burden over the last 20 years or so. Latin America and the Caribbean today collect about 17% of GDP in taxes. And this is low compared to other more developed countries such as the OECD, but it's at par with less developing regions such as Asia and Africa. And there is still potential, as Pablo has mentioned, to increase the tax burden. We have estimated that it's around 3% of GDP, given the level of income per capita for the region. And this 3% of GDP can come 80% of that from taxation on income. And as mentioned to you, there was significant improvement over the last 20 years. Changes in tax burdens from 1990 to 2010 in the Caribbean region increased by about 3% of GDP. And this is significantly more so than other regions in the world. And this is true for all the taxes in the region, and particularly for the case of the value-added tax, which is constitute the major pillar of the tax system in the region. And it's also true for most of the countries in the region, with exceptions of three, which are exporting oil-exporting countries, and this includes Venezuela, Mexico, and Trinidad and Tobago. Second point, are taxes regressive in the region? And this is a maybe, and there is big losses to avoid the value-added taxes regressivity and also to promote the progressivity in the personal income taxes. And let me explain this. If we estimated the incidence of value-added tax by income and consumption, by income is obviously very regressive. However, when we measure the incidence based on consumption, there is a slight progressivity in the region in this particular tax. This comes as a lot of expensive. And why is that? Because the progressivity in the VAT implied that on average there is a 20% loss of potential revenue that comes from the exemptions of goods and services on value-added taxes. Not only that, this is very inefficient and ineffective of the 20% that is lost on potential revenue, about 40% of the bottom part of the income distribution benefit only 3%, while the 20% richest of the population perceive about half of this exempting. Why? Because the rich consume more. That's simple. Second point that I wanted to mention is, what about income taxation, particularly personal income tax? It's well designed on paper. However, it's an empty shell, and that's what we name it in the book. Why is it an empty shell? There are four major reasons. One, the tax brackets and the tax rates are designed in a way that basically nobody pays personal income tax except the top 20% of the income distribution. Second, there is significant exemptions, and therefore the tax base is significantly reduced. Third, income that come in from capital investment are not taxed, basically, in the region. And fourth, there is significant evasion. So people do not pay taxes because there are significant ways of avoiding paying taxes. In summary, the personal income tax, on paper, seems to be very progressive, but 80% of the population pays zero, and the very rich pay effectively 4%. 4%, this is, Mitt Romney here is paying 13, 14%. In Latin America, the very rich are paying 4%. So, we also calculated there was significant change in income distribution before and after taxes, and the impact is almost nil. Let me move to the last one, the rampant evasion. And this is correct. Yes, in income tax, lower in value-added tax. And why? It is very easy and risk-free to avoid, as was mentioned before. Between corporate income tax and personal income tax, it has been estimated that it's at least 50% of potential collections that are being evaded. And this, on top of that, that is 25% of collections from value-added tax are also evading. Already, Jose Juan mentioned, the reason is that only 3% annually the taxpayers in Latin America are subject to some kind of mass audit, and 0.2% are subject to in-depth audit. And remember, only 10% of the population in Latin America are registered as taxpayers. This is compared to 60% in the case of OECD countries. Let me finish proposing some of the policy reform for our discussion. So there is significant room for improvement in policy reform, both on income taxation, both at the personal level and corporate income tax, as well as value-added tax. Some of the proposals are reduced minimum exempt level, cap deduction progressively, adopt a dual income tax, taxing labor income differently and progressively from capital income, on corporate income tax, phase out special regimes, reduce tax incentives, decrease rates. And these are some of the implications that could have in terms of revenue, equity, and efficiency. And finally, on value-added tax, eliminate exemptions, unify rates, compensate poor households with direct transfers. All of these had to be complemented by strengthening tax administrations and combat evasion. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Pablo, José Juan Vicente, for this very interesting and important presentation. Now we are going to go to very short comments by Augusto and Michael, 6 minutes, and then we'll start the discussion. Augusto.
Thank you very much. I have to first congratulate both my colleagues at the IDB and the CAF for tackling an issue that with which everybody feels uncomfortable, which is taxes. I want to make comments on three dimensions of this very important topic, and particularly important for Latin America. The three dimensions I want to say something about are, first, the linkages between taxation and democracy. The second one is the linkages between taxation and efficiency. And the third one is the links between taxation and equity. So these are thoughts that I'm going to try to pose a bit like a challenge to my colleagues, because they are so difficult that I find myself not finding an easy answer. On the first one, taxation and democracy, I think a good point of departure is that the tax system is essentially a tool of power. So the issue that rises is it the power of the people, by the people, and for the people, or is it the power of a tyrant, or the power of special interest groups? And I wish there would have been a little more discussion of this in your reports, because I think it's at the crux of where Latin America is. Latin America is trying to find a path between democracy and equity, and that requires a difficult contracting arrangement. Now, we are used to think in the West that the state is some sort of the result of a social contract. It's a useful construct, but when you go to Latin America, it's not clear whether the states that we have built are a result of a social contract or something else. But if you go through the issue of social contract, it seems to me that there are two important considerations to link better taxation and democracy. One is that taxation has to be couched in a robust system of checks and balances. And that means a court system, a contractual system, the rule of law. And what I think you guys were saying, which is hugely important, the perception that the tax authority is professional and is representing some sort of the citizenship. So that's one. And the second one is this idea that through the tax system, citizens and the state enter in some sort of implicit contracts. And so that, I think, needs two dimensions. One, that there has to be some perception of fairness somewhere there. And second, that citizens opt into the contract rather than opt out of the contract. And in this regard, I wanted to mention a very important result of our most recent flagship study on the rise of the middle class in Latin America, which was that we found strong evidence that middle classes in Latin America have a strong tendency to opt out. Let me give you a couple of examples. The moment a middle class household, a household becomes a middle class household, the first thing they do is they try to take their kids out of public schools and they put them in private schools. The moment they get a little bit of more money, they will try to move to a gated community that has walls and private security. In other words, there's a tendency for households as income rise to privatize services that should be provided by the state. And so you have a very difficult gap there. How do you bridge that gap? How do you make sure that as people have more income, they actually want to opt in? And opting in means you are willing to pay taxes, you're willing to engage into the social dialogue, you want to be a better citizen, and you demand better public services so that you're more willing to pay. That doesn't seem to me as easy as perhaps I heard Pablo presenting this very interesting framework of accountability and reciprocity. So one thought we had with Nancy Bersa a long time ago when we talked about this was that And I will finish them. Is that why is it that in some countries, when you ask a person, and this is the U.S., when a person becomes a U.S. citizen, they tend to link that very closely to the fact that they pay taxes. Why is it that other countries don't get that connection? We speculated with Nancy about one thing that may help, and I wonder whether what you think about that. It's that in the U.S., instead of getting an income tax exemption, you actually pay taxes and then you get taxes back. So I think there's a different psychology associated with just I am poor or I am not middle class, therefore I don't pay taxes. Whereas taxes are deducted from whatever my low income is, and then at the end of the year I get the taxes back. It seems to me that in the second instance, the citizen is more likely to feel, even though poor, engaged in the social contract. I only have 1 minute, and I want to just put two things on the table. On taxation and efficiency, of course, efficiency is about how efficient is the tax system to collect, and second, does it have effects on incentives, on investment and saving? And I was hoping to see more on this idea of how can the tax system help savings effort, which seems to me very important for growth. So I'd like some reaction on that from my colleagues. And second, there's a thought that John Williamson put long time ago there, and I think now we have the technology, we have the information systems to do it. Why not the IDB and the CAF and perhaps the World Bank advocate for global income taxation? If you save in Latin America, you put your assets outside, but that doesn't mean that your income from outside should be exempt from taxes. Now it seems to me that we have the legal framework as well as the technology to move to global income taxation. Finally, one last word on taxation and equity. I wonder, you know, in Latin America, you have a lot of earmarking of taxes. And I wonder whether earmarking is the result of a political economy where people don't trust the state to direct the taxes to the right expenditures. So it's inefficient, blah, blah, but it may be one way to solve the problem. And the second dimension on fairness, which I think is very important in Latin America today, is are we fairly taxing natural resource rents? You know, it seems that many countries in Latin America feel that foreign investors or whoever is getting the natural resource rents is getting is not being fairly taxed given the huge rise in prices. What is it that we are proposing on taxation of natural resource systems, not only to improve the efficiency and the mobilization side, but also the fairness perception?
Okay, thank you very much, Augusto. Very interesting as usual. Michael.
Thank you very much. Well, I should confess straight away that I'm not a Latin American expert. I also have the setback that I agree with much of what is said in the two excellent pieces we're discussing today. So what I thought I'd do is just pick up some more general themes that I think are common to both of the pieces and also try to be a little bit contrarian, even heretical, at various points, overstating my case for effect. And maybe I'll pick up just three things. One is the link between taxing and spending. Second is kind of the state-building issue. And thirdly, maybe say a little bit about the income tax at the end. I was going to talk a little bit also about informality, which I think is an important issue, but since it wasn't explicitly brought up in the presentations, maybe we can save that for discussion. So I think first on the linking taxing and spending, clearly I agree this is clearly a critical thing to try and do better. And I think certainly, for example, we at the IMF, some of our TA, I think, has not made the link as clearly as it might. You know, we often advise countries on expanding the base of the VAT, and then we say, well, look after the distributional implications of that on the spending side. They say, how do you do that? And we say, well, we'll send another mission to tell you that. We kind of need to join things up. We try to do this better. But nonetheless, I think the key issue is how do you make these links between taxing and spending better? And just a couple of thoughts here. One is transparency. Well, transparency is clearly important, but really, is it enough? Let's assume it's necessary. Is it actually sufficient for progress on many of these things? And I should say transparency is clearly a fund mantra, something we put a lot of work into, so I'm not downplaying it. But I think You know, I think of my own country, the UK, for example, where we have extensive, one of our tax problems, echoed, I think, in many of the countries we're talking about, is we have extensive VAT exemptions, particularly for food. Now, everybody knows and can easily find out, this has been a topic of public debate for decades, that we could remove the zero rating of food, increase benefits to protect the poorest so the poorest could be better off, and still have a lot of money left over. Yet this never happens. It's perfectly transparent. Everyone knows it. The issue is, why doesn't that happen? And I think, you know, we have to think of very practical things of actually, you know, I think people actually like to see the cash in some sense link between the two. And we don't. Iran isn't often mentioned as an example of a kind of a good reformer, but for example, Iran managed to substantially reduce its fossil fuel subsidies by putting cash in people's bank accounts, and if necessary, setting up bank accounts to do that. And I think there's some echoes in that in some of the ideas that are in these publications about the personalized VAT that I know the IDB has done a lot of work on. Of course, another problem, I think, is what do you do when you need the revenue actually for consolidation needs? Maybe less of an issue here, but certainly something we think about quite a lot in other parts of the world at the moment, where the benefit of the tax is not some nice public spending, it's actually paying off debt that you never saw much benefit from probably in the first place. It doesn't kind of quite work then. And as a Brit, I can't really help but think, we had the American Revolution mentioned, that really the problem there was that we didn't link, arguably wasn't the democracy, we didn't link the taxing and the spending. We did the spending up front in the Seven Years' War, or whatever it was, the French-Indian War, and then we came along with the bill afterwards. That's not going to work. So there's kind of a consolidation aspect. Second thing I wanted to mention on linking taxes and spending was actually the point that you raised, earmarking. Earmarking is kind of the elephant in the room, it seems to be here. And it would have been nice, I think, to hear some views on that. Of course, public finance people tend to hate earmarking because, you know, if it works, if it actually influences public spending, then it introduces kind of inflexibility into spending. If it doesn't really constrain your spending, then it's really very untransparent. You're basically lying to people. So we don't like it, typically. We know there's a lot of it that still goes on in the region. I think in Central America, it's still up to 50% of public spend, of public revenue, I understand, is earmarked. So it would have been useful to have the risks, I think, spelt out in this context. Though I also think, agreeing with you, this is where it gets heretical, to think, well, actually, maybe we need to think about this a little bit more, at least understand it more. There's some earmarking that we say is fine. We don't even think of it as earmarking. Whole social contributions is basically earmarking a particular charge to a particular purpose. We talk about property taxes going to finance local government expenditure. That's a kind of earmarking. So what are environmental taxes, which I know IDB are particularly stressing as a way forward, we know from many countries those are very often earmarked to particular functions. So I think we need to know more a bit about when earmarking might make sense, when it doesn't. If the only way you can do a reform is by earmarking, is that a price at some point you would pay? And there is a little, we can talk later, there's some evidence on trust and earmarking from some of the states in the US, but we can talk about that later. Second thought, general issue, then I want to say something about state building, this idea that paying taxes helps to build democratic, effective and fair governments. Okay, so what does that actually mean? What does that mean about the advice that people like the IMF should give on taxation policy and administration that we haven't been saying for decades? What's actually new? One might be earmarking, which we've already mentioned. Another difficult one, I think, is the idea, well, actually, the way to get people really involved in the politics of taxation is to impose really bad taxes. Poll tax in the UK is something like it's how you get people really involved. On the other hand, you have a technically good tax, which can be resource rent taxes, and that's fine. That's a good tax, but it's bad for these kind of participation issues. So does this mean we should go around advocating bad taxes because that's how you really get people elevated? There's an element of seriousness in this. What should we do different? The third area, I think, is the treatment of small enterprises, where it really can make quite a big difference. And it's one of some amazing figures on how little revenue is raised by this in many of the Latin American countries that we see in the presentation. Of course, the question is, well, why do we bother taxing these small companies at all? There's no revenue there. Why bother? One argument is a kind of straight economics argument, which says, well, if you don't tax them, there's basically a distortion. There's an inefficiency relative to the firms you are taxing. Another argument you sometimes hear, which you particularly have heard in Latin America, is that you need to, essentially it's a way of empowering small businesses, improves their business practices, brings them more into the economy. So does state building really add more to that concern, to that argument in terms of small businesses? My final point, Just to say one word on the personal income tax. We've heard a lot about the poor performance, and one of the recommendations is to go particularly for a lower threshold. But is that the right? We could argue, is that really the right way to go? You could argue, I think, you know, in some sense, if the very striking figures we saw just now, maybe we should concentrate on that 4% number at the top, more than the 80% who aren't paying, which comes back, I think, to some of your points about what opportunities there might be now with changing sort of international agreements. Because, you know, even if you look at the US, it's only the top 50% who are actually paying any income tax. The rest are net contributors. I think it's something you were hinting at. Maybe there's a political economy story for that. But, you know, maybe you could say that historically in Latin America and in many other parts of the world, we've just made a big mistake by starting with the idea that the income tax should be a mass tax. Mm-hmm. Maybe what we should be doing is starting at the top, making it work properly there, and then spreading it down. You know, if you think about tax reform proposals for the US, for example, one of the most interesting is to say, well, let's take the personal income tax, but raise the threshold massively to $100,000, $200,000, whatever, and keep the income support system and have a VAT to raise the money. So that's a slightly heretical thought that maybe we've just made a big mistake on the personal income tax. We really just need to focus on the top rather than broaden it the other way. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, man. Well, we have a lot to debate about, and I think Augusto and Michael have brought up very interesting dimensions to the proposals by both CAF and the IDB. Let me simply add, I would like the presenters to address the taxation and democracy thing that Augusto brought up. I think that's very, very important. I tend to believe that voting itself is a very indirect way of controlling the quality and the efficiency of the public's expenditures or the provision of public goods. So we need a production function that is more directly targeted, a production function of information and control that it's more targeted to that. And I was thinking out of personal experience how awfully difficult it is to obtain information from the public agencies in order to be able to produce good evaluations on the efficiency and the quality of the public system. And moreover, you need institutions that would be able to process that information in a way that the public is informed. It's not the public directly that it's going to do the monitoring. People are taking care of their daily lives. I mean, so you need these intermediaries in order to obtain the information to begin with, which is very difficult to obtain even in very democratic countries such as Uruguay. And second, in order to process that information by independent public policy institutions such as this one that would produce that information in order to inform the public. And I think that implies maybe that you want to have checks and balances in the provision of information, and maybe you want to subsidize the process of analyzing and processing the information by these independent knowledge centers. And that's something I just wanted to add to what Augusto said about the checks and balances. The other thing I would like the panelists to address is the what Augusto also said about the middle class opt-out. I mean, the middle classes in many of the countries that have already very high taxes and very poor public services, we have the impression that we have to pay twice for the same things. I mean, we pay taxes, but we send our kids to the private schools. We pay taxes in order to have health provisions, but we get health provisions from private providers. We pay taxes to get good policing, but we have to buy private police. So basically, the middle classes are paying twice, privately and publicly, for these services and this. Opt-out is probably a rational decision when the taxes are very high and the public services are very poor. And finally,
just to add to what Michael said, I mean, we take as a like as immutable truth that we need to have more personal income tax and it has to be more progressive and we need to higher corporate tax and this and that. Just let me take a contrarian view on that on very simple grounds. I mean, look, what are the two highly scarce resources in our region? Saving, we complain about that a lot. So we want to tax corporates that in principle would be promoting saving and investment. We have a scarcity of qualified human capital, so we want higher taxes on human capital and higher taxes on physical capital, on the profitability of physical capital in societies that are capital, physical and human capital scarce. So why would it be efficient and even fair to go that route? That is something I would like the panelists to address. Thank you. You can decide, dear Vicente. Go ahead.
To the right, right? Yeah. let me tackle some of the issues, and particularly the issues on tax and the political context of tax and democracy in particular. In the book, we have a chapter that we discuss, particularly related of the impact of tax reforms and which type of presidential system is more proactive in order to pass reforms. And we have a sample of the majority of the Latin American and Caribbean countries, and the study in the chapter concludes that presidential systems are less reluctant to pass tax reform. And we have collected information over the last few years, and in fact, the parliamentary systems in the regions seems to be more pro tax reforms. And there is a justification of that. The parliamentary system seems to have, as the UK system, better checks and balances. It is not only controlled by the presidential system. Second thing that is significant, and the presidential system does not necessarily reflect the entire population vote, but reflects, in some of the cases, the desire of the elite that influence the elections through lobbies and paying the campaigns of the potential presidents. So the conclusions in our chapter is that the presidential system, which is the major system in Latin America, is not pro-tax reform. Secondly, which is also we have observed, is that the left-winning party in the LAC have pushed for more reforms, for tax reforms. And this apparently has a significant a component of improving the income redistributions of the population. So those are the strong conclusions that we have, and we have reflected in the chapter. In fact, the left-winning parties in the region over the last 10 years, have increased tax collections through tax reforms in an order of 2.5 to 3 percentage points of GDP. With regard to the efficiency issue that was mentioned by both, in fact, the major pillars in the Latin American and the Caribbean countries is the tax on consumption. And therefore, there is an implicit preferred taxations that promote saving and investment. And let me conclude in terms of the impact of the personal income tax. In fact, the middle class doesn't pay any tax in Latin America and the Caribbean. Only 10% of the top decide, the richest of the rich, pays an effective tax rate of 4%, 80%, unless the middle class is qualified as the top 10% percentile of the distribution. The middle class doesn't pay really any tax in the region. 80% of the population in the region pays zero tax on personal income tax. And therefore, that is the reason why they are contracted out. They are just paying, you know, services outside the system rather than paying twice the same service. Finally, with regard to personal income tax, where should we focus this? And I agree with Michael. Perhaps in the short term, and given the complexity, we should focus on the 20%. Remember, as I mentioned in my presentation, that only 10% of the populations are registered as taxpayers. And therefore, we should perhaps focus on that 10% first. But that doesn't mean that we should not expand later to include more taxpayers and have the contribution to the share of the provision of public services in the region.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to make two comments on democracy and taxes and efficiency. On democracy and taxes, I think it's the 1 million question. But it's not just a very good question. It's a very timely question. Because in Brazil, after having for 2 weeks the people on the streets, maybe the only good news is that they are a vibrant democracy. And I have been in this business for nearly 40 years. And my memoirs of things in which people has really felt empowered has been in two occasions. One occasion has been mentioned by Mike, the poll tax in the United Kingdom of Margaret Thatcher. The other one, the catastro in the Spanish government. And the two times people were strong enough to convince the government to quit and to eliminate the reforms were in these two cases. They pass over the Congress, and they force the government to renounce to the reform. I am not very sure that this is the way I want the democracy to work, but this is the way I have seen democracy to work on this relationship between taxes and democracy. But coming back to the Brazilian experience, I don't really worry of what is going on. I think it's a very interesting thing that maybe Brookings has to analyze more in depth, or the ADB or CAF. But I have in this experience three details that I would like to put in front of your eyes. The first thing is, people in the streets in Brazil are not protesting against taxes. They are protesting against the allocation of public resources between health, education, and soccer fields.
Which is important.
It's
coming
important.
From the south.
Well, in Spain, maybe it's the only good news we are going to receive in the next 4 or 5 years. Okay. But this, I think it's important. They are not talking about tax structure. They are not worried, it seems, or the link between taxes you pay and the result of your taxes is not as obvious for the median voter, and maybe we are assuming in our exercise. I think this is something important. The second point is, this is a protest against a municipality. We are not talking about the federal government making wrong decisions about taxes. What we are talking is that what triggered the protest in Brazil were a public company which belongs to a municipality, Sao Paulo, or I remember now the other way,
Rio.
I think Rio. And the protests began. And what is important is that we have been putting on our flagship and your flagship the importance of having the resources at the local level to convert the municipalities in a real player, a real actor, a protagonist of development.
And here, when you tell people, okay, your money is going to this municipality, the protest is against the soccer field, which are in the realm of the federal government, has nothing to do with the bus companies, but people are protesting against these bus companies having more resources in a country in which inflation is running very high. And my guess is that what is important is that to have transparency and to have the knowledge to know what is the kind of transfer and subsidies, crop subsidies that you have, it's so hard for the people that maybe transparency, it's one of the things that we have to, it's maybe the tax reform, it is very important to reinforce the control, the audit, it's very important, but to have simple information, to have people having their own decision in a proper way, I think it's very important. I'm going to make a very small comment on efficiency, because as we, Augusto and myself, we were here 3 months ago talking about our respective macro report and talking about in the IDB macro report about informality and the cost for GDP growth in Latin America of having this very high, huge informality rate. 56% of the total labor force in Latin America works for the informal economy, and this has a devastating effect on our total factor productivity. What is interesting is if you go to our flagship, our modern revenues, and you look at what happened with the small and medium-sized companies, you will see that small and medium-sized companies and informality are very close relate, and the decline in productivity or the impact, negative impact of productivity is related to the fact that we have too many small and medium-sized companies which are too small and which grow as small companies and are going to die as a small company. And if you go and see why this happened, you have a lot of reason, but one very clear reason is that in no single country of Latin America you can find a fiscal regime in which you don't have a special treatment of small and medium-sized companies. And we make a fuss of this system. You have a very, very, very difficult situation. You introduce distortion. You know what you get from these small and medium-sized special regimes in Latin America? In the country in which you have the highest revenues is 0.8% of GDP. In most of these countries, the revenues you get from the small and medium companies is less than 0.2% of GDP. We have huge number of, but do you know any authority that is ready to go and to say, people, I am going to eliminate these small and medium-sized special regimes because we want to be efficient and we want to be fair? I don't think that you are going to find that unless you put the numbers on the table and you say this is costing you a huge amount in terms of formal economy of these companies which are small, wanted to become less smaller than they are. I think these important things that we have to talk, it's not just efficiency, it's that the political economy of getting this efficiency is very hard.
Pablo, as brief as I know we can, have very, then we'll
just one. You know, I congratulate that you find the idea that you know, tax reform has been much more implemented in the more parliamentary systems. This is related with the idea that maybe those regimes are more prone to develop fiscal institutions like budget rules, etc., in which people, you know, there is a first. Political representation of all parties. Second, there are possibility of participation of people directly through any other ways, like consultation schemes, etc. Third, that there is a lot of transparency of information about budget expenditure, etc. And fourth, that there are institutional capacities. You know, people congressional committees that have no know about fiscal things. You know, independence of the audit boards, etc. So somehow, I'm saying that this check and balance that you have to have for taxes to create institutional building are there, and the evidence seems to be consistent with that. And just to finish it, you know, Mikey was saying maybe we need
crazy taxes to involve people. I mean, this pool tax get people mad and political participation. This is interesting because from the financial fiscal point of view, we economists say that the pool tax has no efficiency cost, so it should be a tax we should implement. And it's the type of tax that generates a lot of people, you know, mad. And maybe because, of course, has a redistribution consequence that is very negative. So somehow, a progress in taxation that increases a lot in developed countries, how you say, how is this privacy taxation has been, you know, politically established and the richest allow them to be taxed more than the poor? How is this so? Even though it's so redistributive, you may have the political pressure against that, but not. You know, this has been done. So this is because, you know, it's kind of political equilibrium. It was checks and balance, and people who have the most income are paying more. But all, even medium income people in here, these countries, and in many countries, developed countries, pay taxes. So for state capacity building, you need taxes to reach not only the richest. They have to reach the middle income, and even some of the poor, but of course paying very little, because people need to know that, to have a service, you have to pay for it. And once you do that, you are in, you know, you want to control the guy. So, and this is had to be not only the richest, but also some of the poor, of course, pay very little. So sometimes we have this state thing capacity makes us think about political tax policy from maybe another point of view. And as you said, maybe you can get nothing from these poor guys, but you get something which is very important, which is what? Which is empowerment.
Okay, we are going to open it up for a few questions from the audience. Would somebody like to? Guillermo? Guillermo.
Hi, how are you? Okay. When thinking about political economy and all these issues of accountability and reciprocity, I couldn't help but think about the relationship we have in many of our Latin American countries, which is most of us, or many of us, have republics that are federations, like Argentina and Brazil, where the government expenditure is mostly done at the subnational level, at the provincial or state level, and not the tax collection is done at the central level. So how is that you could reach this kind of accountability, and to what extent people can take a look at one guy who is taking their money and taking a look at the other guy who is actually spending the money? To what extent is presented challenge, and how is that you think the region could deal with that? Because it doesn't seem like we're going to improve, if I may, or reduce that sort of vertical imbalance we have at the national levels in these countries.
Teresa?
I'm going to ask a little bit difficult question. I was very much involved with this, with the preparation of this book. So I'm not going to ask a technical question. I'm going to ask a question of the panel as to what do you think is going to make the region take the sort of steps of taking effective tax reforms when for so many years, you know, this hasn't happened. I mean, and the tax reform has been essentially dictated by one objective, which is revenue mobilization, where, you know, efficiency, equity, and other simplification of the tax system and so on have played no role. So what makes us all think that this is going to change?
One last question. Anybody? Just wait for the mic, please. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. My name is Julio González, and I'm here from the Embassy of Spain. We've talked about a lot about taxation as a developmental tool, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about personal spending versus taxation and what tool is more efficient as an economic growth tool for GDP. For example, in those inefficient countries that don't spend those at tax money in a very effective way, wouldn't less taxation be more effective because people have more money to spend and they can spend it, they decide how to spend their money instead of the government who are spending it inefficiently. So people could spend it wherever they want.
Okay. Well, we are going to give the panel a chance to respond in 1 minute. And we'll start with Augusto. And we'll come back here too.
I just want to make, I guess, two important points. One, you guys have put on the table a very provocative idea. I think Ernest, in particular, saying
why worry about income tax if that is such a difficult to collect? It creates all sorts of incredible political economy difficulties. We have a savings problem to start with anyhow. We have a shortage of civil servants. So why worry about that? Why not think about a system that has a very strong VAT tax, and then it taxes things that are, for instance, very bad for the environment? Why not put a very big tax on gasoline and fossil fuels, and maybe that's enough to collect revenues? I have a lot of sympathy with that argument, but I think we do need to make a little more research on this, because I don't see any case for income tax from the efficiency point of view. I have a hard time seeing a case for income tax from the distributional point of view, because we all know that expenditure is a more powerful redistributional tool. So if there is any case for the income tax, I think it has to come from the area of the linkages between taxation and democracy, citizenry, participation, the sense that everybody contributes something. And I really wonder whether we need to actually focus on this, because if you're an economist, you have a hard time making a case for income taxation. So we need political scientists, we need sociologists to help us think through why in the world this is important. I do think that from the participation and democracy point of view, there's a link there. I just want to make two more things. I think one is there's a big point made by the IDB report that tax mobilization improved dramatically during the last 10 years. I wonder how much of a fluke that is. I wonder how much is just associated with the terms of trade and consumption expansion, and therefore it's not really solidly grounded on a structural improvement. And I still have that that thought. And finally, I really like what Jose Juan said about the SMEs and informality and the relation between taxation and informality. I think that's very important. One lesson I tend to draw from that is that any system that has big discontinuities has problems. So in that sense, I also think that if we're going to live with an income tax, I don't like too much the idea that say, okay, at such and such a level of income, you are exempted. Yeah. And beyond that, you are. Because it will create all sorts of distortion around that discontinuity, both at the personal income as well as the corporate income.
Michael?
Oh, perhaps just a couple of points that this discussion suggests me. Actually, one, I think the point you make about the discontinuity is important. I think really the question there is, how do you partition taxpayers into different groups, given that, you know, you can have people who are above the threshold who comply, people above the threshold who cheat, people who kind of conceal themselves just below the threshold, people who are genuinely below the threshold and have no, you know, aren't affected by the tax. So I think in a way the problem is you're probably going to have some discontinuity somewhere, but it's not entirely clear where that should be. And I think that is an important research issue, I think. But a couple of other points maybe that struck me. I thought the Brazilian example was very interesting. And I think if I were to think of another case where you can see these kind of issues to the fore in politics, you know, I suspect that when the history of the Arab Spring comes to be written, that actually tax issues will be part of it, because if you look at some of the countries most affected, they were actually quietly going through the kind of reforms that actually are the kind of things we're talking about. So some of these reforms are actually potentially dangerous, it seems, for the existing regime. You know, it's the old de Tocqueville thing, right? The most dangerous time for a regime is when it's reforming itself. So we should maybe bear some of that in mind. And I think maybe also pick up one of your points about, you know, most people aren't going to spend their daily lives checking out, you know, well, you know, this is how much I paid, but there's only, you know, I don't really value this spending much relative to the other one. And the point about intermediaries, and I think one very interesting thing more generally in the last couple of years has been the great power of CSOs, civil society organizations. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about Latin America. I have no sense of that. But, you know, if you think about even this current, you know, debate about Google and Starbucks, so much of this is really now driven by CSOs. Look at the whole financial transactions tax in Europe. It's largely been driven by CSOs. So, and we can argue about whether, in fact, you know, they're actually pushing for the right things. But in terms of actually getting change made, I think they're becoming incredibly influential and powerful in the tax area. And there may be more scope for that in. You know, they can do something the IDB, CAF, and the Fund, World Bank can't really do. And I think there's also an issue of how we interact with them and perhaps channel energies in mutually agreed ways. But anyway, sorry. Yeah.
Thank you, Mike.
You know, the point about decentralization, you are totally right. Many fiscal systems in Latin America has this vertical imbalance in which local governments receive all the money from transfers and get very little taxes, and the federal government tax and, you know, spends a lot just doing transfers to the local government. So that will interrupt or, you know, avoid this kind of reciprocity and empowerment channels. It's not surprising that we find evidence on Brazil about reciprocity because it's one of the more decentralized on the tax side country in the region. So for sure you need to decentralize taxes for this to work. So this is important. This the ADB book has this message. Teresa's question was quite difficult. I'm very pessimistic about this. Why? Because now the governments are receiving, you said, a lot of money from, you know, natural resources. So any incentives that they may have in the crisis because they need to get revenues is now blocked because of this cheap money from heaven. So I quite pessimistic about that. For that, maybe you want to do it. You decentralize local governments, like in Brazil, they want to do more things, and given that they don't have many of them, well, local governments in Brazil, actually, they have natural resources. So that's a problem. If you decentralize that, you are even worse. So anyway, so I'm pessimistic. Just saying that. That's it.
Coming back to the question of Teresa, maybe this is you are asking if this time is going to be different. And Pablo is saying, no, it's not going to be different. We are going to have more fiscal reforms, which the only focus is going to be to raise more revenues. Maybe no. Maybe this is the reason we have written the book. The book is that you are offering them research, and you have been one of the great contributors to the book. We are offering research that if you are focusing on the kind of reforms that we have had in the past in Latin America, growth is going to be hampered by this fiscal system. And growth is what the region needs. I think that slow growth is coming. The region is going to have very difficult times to grow faster than 4%. The middle class is going to be there, and they are going to ask politicians to deliver better than they have been delivering in the past. And my guess is that at least we have offered them a roadmap to make the reforms that could increase productivity. Because the Greek question for Latin America, it's not efficiency, it's not fairness, it's productivity. How you increase productivity in the region? And I think the tax reform is one of the very, very crucial tools. Vicente.
Very quickly, on the vertical imbalance, I agree, and we have written in the book significant evolution of taxation power, tax handles at the national level. And that's, you know, the principle where you are putting closer demander and producer of services, and I think that's key. On Teresa, I am a bit less pessimistic than Pablo. And you can see over the last 10, 15 years in the region, fiscal policy has significantly improved. And not only that, you know, some fiscal institutions has also improved. So there are some room for continuing to these trends. And I believe that building institution is a long-term process. And I think the former Prime Minister of UK, Brown, Mr. Brown says, you know, building institutions, the difficult part is the first 500 years. After that, it's very easy.
100 years.
Finally, in terms of which is more efficient, leaving the private sector more disposable income or taxing and having a more active public sector. And there is a balance because there are the necessity of producing public goods and services, and you cannot let leave that necessarily and exclusively to the private sector.
Well, just to close, we don't seem to like discontinuities, but we actually live in very discontinuous societies in Latin America. I mean, we are highly unequal, highly fragmented, with a huge informal sector. And maybe the discontinuities that we see in the tax systems are a reflection of what we are. I mean, we can only tax very few people, so we cannot broaden the base very easily. Since we can tax very few, we have to put very high taxes. Those very high statutory taxes are not easy to pay, and then you bring up special regimes to bring down the high statutory taxes, or you look to the other side and saying, well, if there is a little bit of evasion, that's the way in which the fact I'm reducing the taxes, that I'm burdening on the few that are actually able or I'm able to collect taxes from. So I don't think that the things we see are completely arbitrary. I think they are an endogenous response to the societies we are in, the societies we live in, and the growth of the middle classes, if that's a sustained fact of life, and I agree with Augusto, the we still have to see the end of the movie there, maybe that can bring a very, we can be positive, we're more optimistic that that can bring a demand for change as the base is broadened spontaneously by the growth of the middle classes. Thank you all very much, and see you next time. Thank you.